In 1945, the atrocities and consequences of World War II forced the leaders of the day to find a new diplomatic channel to negotiate international peace, security, and cooperation. The initiative led to what we know today as the United Nations and replaced the existing League of Nations. Today, the UN has 193 member states, and it's led by its chief administrative officer, the UN Secretary General. Since its creation, there have been 9 UN Secretaries General working alongside governments to secure peace and stability around the world. From wars to genocide, invasions, migration, natural disasters and health crises, the UN has tried to find solutions and provide assistance to tens of millions. The role has been famously described as the most impossible job on earth. But how does the current Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, see his position in today's world? Ahead of the UN's 76th General Assembly, Guterres discusses the recent developments in Afghanistan, climate change, and of course, the COVID-19 pandemic. Is the world going in the wrong direction? The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, talks to Al Jazeera. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, thank you for talking to Al Jazeera. You've almost completed your first 5-year term as Secretary General, and congratulations, in June, you were elected for another 5 years. The first UN Secretary General, the Norwegian Trygve Lie, famously described it as the most impossible job on earth. So how hard is it being UN Secretary General?
Well, on one hand, it's a difficult job. On the other hand, it's a fascinating job. We will not be able to solve all the problems of humankind, and the power of the Secretary General is much smaller than what people think. I mean, member states are in command of this house. The Secretary General is the chief administrative officer, and the only thing I have is the possibility of good offices. But whenever we are able to do something that ends a conflict, or whenever we are able to do something that increases humanitarian aid to a population in distress, or whenever we are able to do something to make sure that governments in relation to climate change what they are supposed to do, I mean, this is extremely rewarding. Whatever we can do, sometimes for one person, when you cannot save the world, but whatever you can do to help the life of individual people. And I was High Commissioner for Refugees for 10 years. I mean, it's a fascinating job.
One thing that clearly has been taking up a lot of your time in recent weeks is the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan. Tell me about that. What worries you most about what could come next?
Well, there are many worries. The situation is unpredictable. And I understood was that some people think the UN can solve all the problems of Afghanistan. Now they say, oh, now the UN is the organization that stays in Afghanistan, so you are going to solve all the problems that others for 20 years were not able to do so, even if they had hundreds of thousands of soldiers or trillions of different currencies to spend. Now, it is clear that our leverage is very limited, but we are totally committed to support the Afghan people. And for that reason, I think we were the first international organization that sent a high-level delegation to Kabul and that engaged directly with the Taliban to allow for humanitarian aid to be effectively distributed to the Afghan people. Now, what I'm afraid is that all these efforts might fail. What I'm afraid is, because the situation is unpredictable, that it would be a disaster if there wouldn't be an inclusive government in Afghanistan. It would be a disaster if the economy would collapse. It would be a disaster if the rights of women and girls would be dramatically violated. It would be a disaster if terrorist organizations could operate again from Afghanistan. And I think we need to do everything possible to reach the opposite, to push for the Taliban to understand the importance of an inclusive government that takes into account the diversity of the different groups, that to do everything possible for the Taliban to understand that it is essential to respect a number of basic rights of women and girls. I mean, Nobody wants or thinks possible that Afghanistan becomes a Nordic country. But there are basic rights, the right of women to work, the right of girls to study, that it's very important that they understand are essential. To do everything we can to persuade them that the fight against terrorism is something in which they must be united with the whole of the international community. So knowing that we don't know what the future will bring, I know one thing. If we don't engage, we'll get nothing. If we engage, and at the same time, if we prove our added value by providing humanitarian aid to a people that is in a dramatic situation, with millions and millions on the verge of dying because of hunger, if we don't do this, then it is clear that things cannot move in the right direction. So it's our duty to do everything possible to support the Afghan people and to help create the conditions for those concerns that everybody has about terrorism, about human rights, about inclusivity, to materialize.
You've mentioned the prospect of a total collapse of the economy. We've already seen the banking system in Afghanistan is barely functioning. What would a collapse look like, and what would it mean in terms of refugees in the region and even as far as afield as Europe?
No, it would be a total disaster. It would be lots of people dying, and I believe a massive outflow into the neighboring countries with horrible consequences for the stability of those countries. So I think it's very important to avoid that collapse. I've been saying that humanitarian aid is essential, but at the same time, it's necessary, and of course there are ways to do so, even in respect for international law, it's essential to inject some cash to allow the Afghan economy to breathe and to avoid the kind of collapse that would have devastating consequences.
When we go back 20 years to 9/11, you were the leader of a NATO country. You were the Prime Minister of Portugal. Since then, you've been the High Commissioner for Refugees, visiting Afghanistan many times. Few people have the same insight as you on what happened in Afghanistan. Tell us, in your view, what went wrong?
I think everything went wrong. First, the idea that the Afghan people can be ruled from outside. I mean, the British tried and failed, the Russians tried and failed, the Soviets at the time, now the Americans tried and failed. The Afghan people is a people that is very proud, and they have lots of problems among themselves, but they have even more problems with the idea that it can be dominated from the outside. On the other hand, I think that there was too much military action and not enough support to building institutions. I mean, unfortunately, the Afghanistan leaders were also divided. We had two elections with contested results. Probably the model of election that was adopted in Afghanistan, that was a unitary system, was not the most adequate for a country that is so decentralized. So the truth is that there was a huge dysfunctionality in the government, and we have seen it in the relations of the president with, and the international community looked at it without any capacity to really allow things to improve. And so all these fragilities accumulated, and in the end we had what we had, and we had it in a very chaotic way that nobody was forecasting. I think it was impossible to think that an army of hundreds of thousands of people with the best equipment that was would disappear in 7 days.
Some here in the US saying NATO and the US shouldn't have been doing nation building. You seem to be saying they should actually have been doing more nation building and less bombing people and fighting.
Nation building is probably the wrong concept. I think what is important is to create the conditions for a country to find its own way. The problem of nation building is that sometimes we try to impose a model copied from other parts of the world, in which the culture, the social relations, the ethnic diversity are completely different. We need to act with the people of a country, understanding the people of the country, understanding their culture, understanding their traditions, understanding their history, and obviously helping them to adapt to the modern times, but not trying to project on them what we are.
In 2001, the UN envoy then, Lakhdar Brahimi, played a central role in bringing different political figures together and forming a government. This time, it seems the UN is focusing on the humanitarian side, yet the Taliban did say at one point they wanted an inclusive government. They've come up with a cabinet that only includes members of the Taliban. Should the UN not be playing a similar role now, trying to nudge the Taliban in that direction?
But that was a different situation. It was a situation in which there was the creation of conditions for after the defeat of the Taliban, the creation of conditions to bring together the different groups that were together in the construction of that defeat. Now the situation is completely different. The Taliban won. And obviously, the Taliban do not accept that there is an entity that will be now brokering an agreement. What is important is to express to them clearly our point of view, that in the interest of Afghanistan and in their interest, it's very important that the different ethnic groups are represented in the government of the country. This is a negotiation that they need to do by themselves, and at the same time, that is important to have a women presence in the structures of power of the country.
UN officials have been engaging, as you say, with the Taliban. You say it's important to engage, and yet when you look at the cabinet members of the Taliban government, 33 cabinet members, many of them are on the UN sanctions list, including the Prime Minister, both the Deputy Prime Ministers and the Foreign Minister. Doesn't that make things difficult for you?
First of all, the humanitarian principles are clear. Humanitarian action is based on impartiality, neutrality, and independence, and on needs-based approach. And in humanitarian action, you need to speak with everybody. You even have to speak with terrorist organizations when necessary to provide assistance to people.
Do you believe the Taliban is still a terrorist organization, as it has been judged in the past?
I think the Taliban now want to rule the country. And we don't know what's going to happen. As I said, the situation is unpredictable. But I think that there is at least a part of the leadership of the Taliban that would like to have Afghanistan as a country recognized by the international community and would be ready to pay a price for that.
You say part of the leadership. In your assessment, how united is the Taliban right now?
Well, we know that it's the news that there are complex negotiations in the formation of the government, so it is clear that the group that was formed as the Taliban was formed is not exactly like a social democratic party in Northern Europe. I mean, it's a group, I'm sure, with divisions, with different perspectives. People have fought in different areas of the country with different ethnic groups. So, I mean, it would be an illusion to think that we are dealing with a monolithic institution.
I was in Geneva a few days ago and I watched you launch your flash humanitarian appeal for Afghanistan, and I heard you say about the Afghan people, they want their lives and basic freedoms to be protected. They want what every member of the human family wants and deserves. But in that speech, and every time I've heard you talk recently about Afghanistan, there's one word you don't mention: democracy. Has the international community now given up on the idea of democracy for Afghanistan?
I think what is essential at the present moment is to guarantee that basic human rights, especially for women and girls, are respected. That is my main concern. On the other hand, for the stability of the country, it's important that the country is inclusive. To think that we will witness immediately a process of construction of a liberal democracy like exists in
Europe. But there was a sort of democracy. It wasn't perfect.
May I finish? A liberal democracy, I think it would be totally naive. That we want the government to be inclusive and that we want the government to accept, for instance, freedom of expression, that we want the government to respect the rights of women and girls, these are steps that are important in line of a democratic view of the world, but we have no illusions that a typical liberal democracy will work immediately in Afghanistan. And let's be honest, there are many countries in the world where that doesn't happen.
Well, let me talk about some of the countries around the world where democracy is potentially under threat. We've seen coups in Mali, Myanmar, Guinea. We've seen the suspension of parliament in Tunisia, the assassination of the prime minister in Haiti. How worried are you about democracy in the world?
I'm very worried. I think that not only democracy, I'm worried with the fact that more and more we see power taken by force. And I see how divisions are increasing within societies, polarization of societies, the death of truth, when the same fact is described in totally different ways by different politicians and different groups within the society. Populism, xenophobia, racism. I think there is a number of serious threats that are happening today in the developed world, in traditional liberal democracies. There are serious threats that need to be faced.
In a matter of weeks, it'll be the first anniversary of the clashes in Tigray and of the military intervention by Ethiopia. In the early stages, I know you used your relationship with Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed to try and calm things down. He told you that there were no Eritrean troops in the country, and yet they were. They were executing people, they were raping people. He told you he was going to open up humanitarian access. That still hasn't happened. Tell me, are you disappointed in the Ethiopian Prime Minister?
I am disappointed with the Ethiopian situation in general. Ethiopians have, in my opinion, failed in their capacity to address the problems of their own diversity. And I'm very worried about the situation. Because we have been engaging both the government, the Prime Minister, and the TPLF. Martin Griffith visited the leadership of the TPLF, and as you know, when I made the appeal for a ceasefire, for free humanitarian access to all areas of the territory, and for the beginning of a Ethiopian-led dialogue, we received a letter from the leadership of the TPLF. Showing their interest also in cooperating with UN. The drama is that I think both sides are still convinced they can win the war. And I'm deeply convinced that there is no military solution. I don't think that it is possible to defeat the TPLF in Tigray, namely, because it is clear that they are very strongly integrated in the society and that they have a real fighting capacity. And I also think that there is no way the Tigrayans can rule Ethiopia as in, to a certain extent they did in the past. So it is obvious there is no military solution, and it is obvious that they need to come together. We hoped that the humanitarian access would be the way to facilitate things. And the truth is that we still do not see the will to stop the war and come to a serious dialogue for a solution. I hope this will happen sooner rather than later, because the risks for Ethiopia are huge, a collapse of Ethiopia would be a disaster for the region and it would be tragic for the Ethiopian people.
Jeffrey Feltman, the US special envoy, he actually said this dramatic quote that Ethiopia could make Syria look like child's play. Do you agree?
I'm afraid if there would be a collapse in Ethiopia with the complexity of the Ethiopian society, I think that image would probably be a real one.
One conflict which has looked more hopeful this year is Libya, because you had the formation of a new national unity government, you had a roadmap towards elections, but you still have the foreign forces there, and you don't seem to have an agreement yet to hold those elections in December. You've not even got an agreement of what sort of elections they're going to be, presidential or parliamentary or both. Are you worried that the progress you've seen this year could now unravel?
I'm worried about Libya. It's good that the fighting did not resume. It's good that I feel that there is a kind of equilibrium that doesn't allow easily for a full start of the conflict as it was in the past. But the truth is that we are not making progress in the legal constitutional aspects allowing for the elections to take place. I believe that we must make immediate progress, at least on making some of the mercenaries leave. But our objective remains the same. Libya must be a sovereign, independent country. There is no room in Libya for foreign mercenaries or foreign troops.
The warlord Khalifa Haftar looks like he wants to be the president, wants to run for president. He's someone who clearly has blood on his hands. He's been accused, or some of his forces have been accused, of war crimes. Should someone like that be eligible for high office in Libya?
This is something the Libyans need to decide. And this is one of the things the Libyans are discussing at the present moment. And it is obvious for me that we should have, as president of Libya, someone that would deserve the consensus of the Libyan society. That would be, in my opinion, the best solution. Will that be possible? I hope it will. I think Libya needs someone that unites the country instead of someone that divides the country.
Let's move to COVID-19. And you're aware that some parts of the world are getting back to normal. They think COVID-19 is over. Do you agree?
No. COVID-19 is not over. COVID-19 has been a terrible demonstration of the failure of human solidarity. This was a terrible ethics test that the international community has failed. I've been asking for months for a global vaccination plan. I've been asking for months for an emergency task force under the G20, that where all the countries that matter are, in order to be able to double the production of vaccines and to guarantee an equitable distribution of vaccines. This is not happening. We have seen vaccine nationalism, then vaccine diplomacy, but we are not seeing people coming together and finding a common solution. And this is a tragedy, and unfortunately, the COVID has not been defeated. The problem is, we all know that the challenges we face cannot be solved by a country-by-country basis. We all agree that we need multilateral institutions to address the common challenges of the world. The problem is that our multilateralism has no teeth. Look at the World Health Organization. They cannot even get the information they need. They cannot even do an investigation of a situation. Our multilateral institutions have, as I said, no teeth. And sometimes, when they have teeth, they have not much will to bite, as it is the case of the Security Council.
Of course, there's one global crisis that is worse than COVID-19, and that is the climate crisis. You have the COP meeting coming up in Glasgow in just a matter of weeks' time, and you've been talking about mistrust taking place between the developed world and the developing world. Do you think that could derail any agreement, and how serious would that be for the world?
It can, and it would be extremely serious, and we must avoid it. We must re-establish trust. I think it's important that developed countries understand that they need to do more in support to developing countries, namely fulfilling their commitments made in Paris, but going beyond that, that international financial institutions need to be much more active in support to developing countries. That support needs to be concentrated not only on reduction of emissions, but also on what we call adaptation, which means building resilience of communities, of infrastructure, helping countries resist to the impacts that already exist in climate change. And that we are seeing the vulnerabilities everywhere. We are in New York. Even here, we had some heavy rain, and 45 people died in the region around New York. I mean, even the most important financial center in the world is vulnerable to climate change. So it's time to the developed countries to understand that they need to also invest in adaptation, in resilience, in changing infrastructure, in creating new forms of organization of societies in the developing world that lacks the resources to do so. And finally, it's important also that some emerging economies of the developing world, but that are today, because of their dimension, big emitters, make an extra effort. Because, for instance, with the number of coal power plants that is planned today in the world, we would not only not reach 1.5 degrees, or we would not only be below 1.5 degrees of increase of temperature in the end of the century, we'd not be below 2%, we would be completely undermining the Paris Agreement. So there must be an effort from developed and developing countries to bridge the gaps of trust that still exist and to understand that each one must do more.
Finally, Secretary General, we've mentioned that your second term starts soon and it ends in 2026. By then, the UN will have had a man in charge for over 80 years. How important is it that your successor is referred to as Madam Secretary General?
I think it's something that makes full sense. And I have to say that I've done a lot in order to make sure that gender equality and gender parity is the, I would say, the symbol of this organization. We have now gender parity in the 180 leaders of the UN system and in our coordinators around the world. I have pushed for a very strong policy in gender equality. There is only one thing I cannot do, is to be a woman. So I am a man, but gender parity and gender equality are, for me, an absolute priority. Because gender equality is a matter of power, and a matter of power in a world that is male-dominated and with a culture that is male-dominated. And it is essential to change it.
Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations, thank you for talking to Al Jazeera.
It was an enormous pleasure to be with you again.